about 2-3 years ago, I had lunch with Howard's sister and said, and it was kind of an impulse. I just said, I think I'm going to make a movie about Howard. So it was one of those things where you just go, I have to do this because the story was so compelling to me.
So you worked with Howard Ashman throughout your career on a number of films, including Beauty and the Beast, but you were close friends as well. Do you remember the first time that you met him?
I remember meeting him when he was at the studio working on other films, and I was working on Beauty and the Beast at the time. So he was working on Little Mermaid, and he also wrote a song for a movie called Oliver and Company, a Disney animated movie from the same era. And so he was around, and he was in the hallways, and so I remember meeting him then, but we didn't, you know, hang out or anything because he was busy working, and he was only in Los Angeles kind of every other week. He would commute back and forth. So it really wasn't until October of maybe 89 or something like that. We had been working on Beauty and the Beast for a long time, and it kind of fell apart. The story didn't work, and it was a difficult fairy tale to adapt. And Mermaid was just coming out and getting these rave reviews, and that's when we pulled Howard into Beauty and the Beast because he was, with Fallon Menken, just such a brilliant force on these movies. And that's when I started to obviously work with him a little closer.
He wrote some of the most iconic songs in Disney history and really in the world of musicals as a whole. Songs for Aladdin, The Little Mermaid. Can you talk about his talent and what he was able to add to those films that he worked on?
Well, I think it's easy to throw around the word brilliant or genius or whatever, but he was in a way. And then on top of that, he had the talent to turn musicals into really and songs into storytelling devices, and that was his big strength. He never wanted to write a song that stopped the movie and you just stopped and listened to a song because he thought that was ridiculous. He thought it was really important for songs to move the plot ahead. So every song, even if it was a love ballad or whatever, whether it was Be Our Guest or whether it was Ursula the Sea Witch's song in Little Mermaid or whatever, was a plot song, and it was something that would move the story ahead. So he would go from, Ursula singing, you would have somebody like Ariel meeting Ursula in Little Mermaid. Ariel hardly knew Ursula existed, and by the end of the song, Ariel's given Ursula her voice. You know, so in 3 minutes, this huge plot thing happened, and that's what Howard's genius was. He was a really good storyteller, much more than just a lyricist. You know, he was part lyricist, part director, part writer, and really contributed however he needed to on a movie. And that's what was so fun about working with him.
I want to ask what it's like for you now to hear those songs.
Well, it's, the songs are always evocative and nostalgic when it comes to the, listening back to them and remembering that time, which is now 25 years ago. When we worked on them. And then there's having worked on Howard on this movie, it's always a little nostalgic thinking about Howard and his contributions, and some of these songs he worked on when he was suffering from HIV and AIDS and was really sick. So he was writing really joyous songs like Prince Ali from Aladdin on his deathbed. He was in the hospital. And Alan Menken would take a piano to his room and they'd write together. But I think that's a little bit why I want to make this movie, because there's a lot of heroism involved in this film. And quite often we tell stories of athletic heroes or political heroes or whatever. We don't have that many artistic heroes in our daily life anyway. And I think Howard's one of those. I think his songs are songs we've grown up on. And to me anyway, he is a little bit of an artistic hero. And I thought his story was really worth telling. Because it's inspiring. It's a kind of a joyful story, really. It has a bittersweet ending, but it's a very, very joyful story about a brilliant guy.
You've said that you didn't want this documentary to be a parade of talking heads just discussing Howard, that you wanted his voice. You wanted him to tell his own story. And so you used found footage primarily. So why take that approach?
Well, I've never loved nonfiction or documentary storytelling that's just a narrator or talking heads. I think it's it doesn't involve the audience in the story. And what I wanted to do was take you back as an audience member and sit you at the tables that I was at. And I was lucky to be there and to put you in the rooms and place you back in that time. Well, that means finding and using old VHS video cassettes that don't look that great or finding old photos. And so much of this movie was finding those things either in the Library of Congress, where Howard's archives are, or in the New York Public Library, or places, in file cabinets at the back of theaters in New York, or wherever we could find materials. And by using all this archival material, it actually transports you back to the 80s and 90s when this story happened. So you can live in the moment and not be pulled out by, old guys and girls reminiscing. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I feel like it's a little bit lazy filmmaking, and I really wanted to transport you back then. Mm. So we use all period footage and then contemporary interviews and recollections. So we get recollections from the people that were there, and including Howard's family and his sister and his mate, Billy, and, people that were there and eyewitnesses to Howard's life.
Did you discover anything about him that surprised you in your research?
Well, you discover a lot of details that are always, surprising. I think the biggest thing was his knowledge. I knew he was knowledgeable and he studied musical theater, but he would, his references in his interviews or in his papers, he would say, okay, the Beauty and the Beast ballad when they're dancing in the ballroom, that's like the King and I, and that's going to be the consummation of their relationship. And so he had all these theatrical references he could go back and forth on. He owned his own theater in Manhattan when he was just out of college. So he went to Indiana University and came to Manhattan in an era, late 70s probably, when there was Manhattan was kind of a mess in many ways. But what that allowed was kind of a bohemian kind of culture that allowed somebody like Howard and his colleagues to open their own theater, their own little 90-seat theater in Manhattan, and put on shows, one of which was Little Shop of Horrors. So you have this guy who's not only talented and a gifted songwriter and lyricist, and he was also a director. He was also a theater owner and had to be part of a businessman to do that. So there's a lot of bravery in his young life and his choices. And, just those kinds of things are always like, what? He owned his own theater, and it was in a horrible section of Manhattan, this little kind of rundown lower Fifth Avenue junky place that was dangerous to go to, but people would go there because Howard Theater was there, and they made the trip down there to see Little Shop of Horrors or so many other shows. So those were the kinds of things I always thought were interesting about him.
So you produced Beauty and the Beast, and Howard wrote the songs, and that was, it sounds like, at the very end of his life. I'm wondering what that time was like for you. You were creating this iconic film, but you were also watching a good friend die.
Yeah, it's true. When you're making a film, it's all-encompassing, and you're working on it and thinking about it all day, all night. When you're working, but also in the shower, and when you're eating, and everything else, because you're trying to make it as good as you can, and you're trying to get it done, which both of which are always a challenge. So, and Howard was never one to want a pity party or something that was about him. He was about the work. So even when he was losing his voice or becoming so sick he couldn't travel, it was about the work. So we could get him on the phone, we could talk, we could have story meetings. It was obvious he was starting to go downhill and get sick, but it was never about that. And I think in a funny way, we never had time to think about his illness and grieve it at the time, because he was just professional about how he approached it all. Obviously, when he finally passed, it was he never saw the completed film, Beauty and the Beast. Well, I showed him a version of it with pencil tests and kind of a work in progress, so he knew what it was. He felt good about it. But he passed away in March of the year before the film came out. So he wasn't able to see the finished film, and I think that's when it started to become obvious that we losing one of your key collaborators was beyond believability, I think, in a funny way. I never thought it would happen, and I don't think any of us did. We always thought, it's Howard. He'll be around, and we'll be able to share this with him. But he wasn't, and it was, I think, only when the movie was done and the reaction was so good that we started to realize there was somebody that wasn't there that we couldn't share it with, and that's when I think our was the bittersweet moment.
What is Howard Ashman's legacy today? What's his impact on the world of animation?
Well, his impact, I think, is on the world of animation, but also in the world of musical theater and storytelling in music. He had hits in his life and he had misses in his life, as we all do. We, you know, none of us who are working in a creative field, whether it's making films or painting or dancing or radio or whatever, we always have hits and misses in our lives. But he was persistent. He was true to his own ideas. He was the smartest guy in the room. He didn't suffer fools. He was also the funniest guy in the room and able to come up with ideas and lyrics that were, you know, ridiculous and hilarious that last. So I think his legacy in animation is certainly helping to bring back that Disney animation in the 80s and 90s that many of us, that I worked on and many of us grew up with. You know, that was the age of video cassettes, and that's the age when people saw Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast 100 times. And so I think those songs are very much in our heart. And then beyond that, I think there's people like Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote Hamilton, who referenced back to Howard and how he grew up on Howard's songs and how he was inspired to tell stories in his work. Alan Menken, who was Howard's writing partner and musician, who's brilliant and still writing. So there's a lot of people out there still working. A lot of Howard's musicals, like Aladdin, are still on Broadway in a way that Howard will never know and has never seen, but his legacy is, you know, out there more than ever. You see it in Disney theme parks. You see it in Disney animated movies. You see it on the Broadway stage. You see it in the remake of things like Beauty and the Beast with Emma Watson and Emma Thompson last year. So there's a lot of Howard out there, and I think that's a little bit why I thought, you know, there's a lot of Howard out there in our hearts and in our films and in our stages, and we don't know the story. And I think that's probably why I went out to make the film.
Don Hahn, writer and director of Howard, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.